Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Clan houses are an important part of culture for many Alaska Natives. A clan house is both a physical structure and a cultural, spiritual, and political unit. There are many thriving clan houses in Alaska, but there are also many that are caught up in legal limbo and end up in private ownership. Today we'll hear about attempts to repatriate one property in Sitka and restore the power of the clan house. We'll hear more about it right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Countless Western Alaskans have lost subsistence resources, food, and even camps that ties them to their land. Residents are devastated and processing what the loss means to them and their families. Various agencies are still assessing the scope of damage from the storm. KNOM's Davis Hovey reports.
Melanie Banke, CEO of Kowarik Inc., shared with KNOM listeners on Wednesday that the damage to subsistence cabins goes beyond loss of buildings.
We've got several people who have lost their subsistence cabins and their boats, and we all know that our subsistence cabins aren't just recreational. They're a means for our food security, but also our cultural continuation. And they connect us to the land and our ancestors.
Banke's point about the cultural connection being affected by the storm has been echoed again and again by Western Alaskans. Darlene Trigg is one of many Nome residents who no longer has a camp for her and her family to enjoy. It was completely washed away by the storm.
My mom and dad took it upon themselves to make sure that all of the kids had subsistence foods, and it all happened there. My earliest memories are in that building, around that land. It's a part of the foundation of who I am. It's built into my identity.
Throughout the Norton Sound region, residents have talked about the impact this storm had on their subsistence lifestyle. Daisy Lockwood Kachiak, the city administrator in Stebbins, told KNOM her community will not have as much food for winter.
100% of the fish racks and fishing supplies for all our subsistence fishermen are gone.
The community is requesting food deliveries from various agencies to help sustain them over the coming days. Alaska's congressional delegation has sent a letter to President Joe Biden urging him to approve Governor Dunleavy's request for a major disaster declaration in Western Alaska. Reporting in Nome, I'm Davis Hovey.
Friday is California Native American Day. This year, the day is the first ever paid holiday for court workers. Native American lawmaker James Ramos successfully introduced a bill in 2021 to allow court personnel to switch Columbus Day for California Native American Day. Ahead of the holiday this week, Ramos talked about the effort and celebrated with bird singers and court officials at the San Bernardino Superior Court, which was streamed online.
We're here standing strong for all of our ancestors and the atrocity that has been inflicted upon them to once and for all have a paid holiday to recognize the contributions and the contributions by the California Indian people to the state of California. And we start with the first paid holiday in the state of California. The whole state, the whole judicial systems, all 58 counties to join together in honoring California's first people.
Judiciary personnel holidays are set in a civil procedure and the change required legislation. Other staff are covered in a government code. The measure amended that to recognize the holiday. It does not create an additional paid holiday, just an exchange. The bill was supported by tribes and Native organizations. On Thursday, members of Washington State's congressional delegation introduced legislation to help the Puyallup tribe place more than 17 acres of land into trust to spur economic development. The tribe seeks to pursue opportunities at the Port of Tacoma and on the Tacoma waterfront. The proposal is supported by the city, county, and the state's governor. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for nearly 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Did you know 1 in 26 people will develop epilepsy during their lifetime? Or that 1 in 10 people will have a seizure? Call 1-800-332-1000 to speak with an epilepsy information specialist. The Epilepsy Foundation supports this show.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. In Sitka, Alaska, Tlingit clan houses are slowly disappearing. Property ownership is often caught between traditional customs and the American legal system. But one traditional clan house property was recently saved from private ownership, and there's hope for rebuilding the structure that is a gathering place and spiritual center for the clan. Known as the Point House, it is one of a handful of properties that fell into disrepair. Its prospective return to the clan and planned development offers promise for reviving similar Tlingit clan houses and spurs further conversations around repatriation and preservation of these important cultural touchstones. Today we're going to talk with members of the clan and others about the importance of Tlingit clan houses and how to keep the tradition thriving. Please join our conversation. How does a story about reviving a clan house resonate with you? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Our first two guests are joining us from Sitka, Alaska. And first on the line is Chuck Miller. He is a caretaker of the Platform House. He is Tlingit. Chuck, welcome to Native America Calling.
Thank you.
Chuck, our next guest, I'm going to go ahead and let you introduce that person for us yourself.
All right. Stutin Yeduwasauke Achik, Jericho Blang, Plate Harenach Yeduwasauk. This is my good friend and clan brother. Stutin is his Tlingit name. He's from the Point House. He's Kiksadi Raven Frog Clan, and his English name is Jericho Blang. Thank you for letting me introduce him.
Thank you for that warm introduction, Chuck. Jerick, hello. Thank you for joining us as well.
Yeah, thanks for having us. Good morning.
Jerick, you've been working to reclaim this property that your clan's people lost legal rights to some years ago. Please start us off by explaining, how did that happen?
Well, a native elder that I knew who lived in the village behind that house, we had gone for a walk one day, and I'm familiar with the property because it's as it stands now, is undeveloped, so it's essentially an empty lot. And we casually walked by it one day, and she pointed to the property and she said, "Jerick, that property belongs to you." And it sounded weird to me. I didn't know what she meant by that, so I didn't really address it. And I was dismissive of it at the time. But later, after we went home, she explained to me that my clan house used to exist there. And it spurred an international conversation of what that was and who it belonged to and who had lived there. And I had had family members who, I guess, in the past had tried to repatriate the said land. So that's how the conversation started, was just a casual walk to the village and someone pointing out that there was something left that felt unfinished.
So the original home, or the structure itself, if I'm not mistaken, was torn down around 25 years ago, and now it's just a lot.
I think I've heard 1997. Was when it was taken down. So, doing the math on that is about 25 years ago. But currently, it's a 1,697 square foot lot in historic downtown Sitka.
So, how was it then? Again, that it this is a clan house. It's many people in this clan have rights to this home. Consider it their property. How was it that the clan lost those ownership rights?
Well, I'm not going to use names because they've asked to be left out of the conversation for this, but essentially my great-grandma, who we're a matrilineal culture, so our identities often come from matrilineal side. My great-grandmother's brother was the last housemaster in that clan house. It's also who my Tlingit name comes from. So I'm not sure if he didn't have children. I'm not quite up to that. But ultimately, when he passed, it was willed to his granddaughters, and they wouldn't be of his clan because we're a matrilineal culture. So then it fell out of Kiksati clan hands, and that's how I got involved with them, was just, you know, a simple property search. I just did a Google search on the city website just to see who they were, and then I cross Facebook them and realized that I could get in touch with them. And so maybe it was an awkward initial phone call when I reached out to them, but now realizing that they're my family members. But I mean, in that one generation, you lose track of people. We didn't know each other. So I didn't know I had them as family to begin with. So that's how I got a hold of them.
So like in many Native cultures, land, property, it's passed on matrilineally. So in this case, that didn't happen. The land was not passed on matrilineally. And why was that? Why did this family or this relative of yours choose to do it differently than what was historically and culturally the norm?
Well, I don't actually think that that was their choice. I just think that the Bureau of Indian Affairs does things in Western culture. So next of kin would not necessarily be next of, you know, matrilineal kin. I think Chuck can maybe elaborate on that. Chuck's living in a home that has used the proper channels to go about things. And I would defer to him to answer how that should work more.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So Chuck, let me ask you, because unlike the Point House and many other clan houses in Sitka, the Platform House, of which you are a caretaker, is still active. So what is the difference? Why is Platform House in a different situation than the Point House? Hi, sorry about that. We had a little technical difficulty there. I think we did lose Chuck. So let's go ahead and just hold off on those questions, regarding, more of that history of the Point House and how it law or the clan members lost possession or those ownership rights to it. But can you tell us a little bit more about what's going on now in the present? So you're currently engaged in gaining possession of Point House for the benefit of your clan's people. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, we went through the process, so everything is managed through Bureau of Indian Affairs. So we started the process of land transfer. It's not exactly quick. So we're currently in that place. We're also doing some pre-development grant seeking to not only work with the state of Alaska. I think we're looking at some state historic preservation office grants to essentially rebuild the way that it was. So that's kind of currently where we're at. We're just in the pre-development stage right now and working with some grant writers and architects over in Juneau to get the project's momentum and moving so people can see something. Because right now, maybe just to an outsider, it looks like an undeveloped lot, you know?
Mm-hmm. And you actually have the deed to the property, right? So there's no question in terms of the ownership. And so what are your plans going forward and what kind of legal restrictions are you facing in terms of how to develop the property to the benefit of all of your clan's people?
Well, the process is not fast. It's not like immediate transfer, like when you go and buy a house, and they record things the same day. So unfortunately, it's not completely through. I mean, I think it will take probably 6 months to a year. But like I said, we're working on some pre-development grants with the state of Alaska. We're also in the fundraising stage right now. We're going to be doing a fundraiser here in December to just kind of do the unveiling and show renderings so people can see something more tangible, because right now it's not a developed lot. I don't think there's not a lot of vision in it that people can see. So we've been doing a lot of historical research, looking for old photos. And James has been great. We pulled some photos from his. He has some actual photos of the demolition. There's also some properties down the road that we've used as kind of a reference point to architectural style and whatnot. And again, I probably might be jumping ahead too far. James could really talk more about the architectural style of the village and what that looks like for people who are from here who haven't seen it.
So do you have a general timeline of when you think it's possible to break ground and get the new structure built?
You know, I don't. You know, one of the most challenging things about this is there's not really a model for me to follow. It's uncharted territory for me. I'm a homeowner myself of conventional property over in Juneau, but certainly never taken on a project of this scope. I think one of the major hurdles that I've run into in the grant seeking process is the complexity of like individual land ownership versus what we consider collective land ownership as a tribal people. And part of the problem being is if I add, you know, 10 people to the deed to this, we have to all agree to get something done. And the bureaucracy behind getting those things passed through BIA, I know there's some land of trust things that have been in process with BIA since 2016. So it creates a real issue for us because part of my issue is finding grants that fit individual homeowners or individual landowners right now.
We're speaking now with Jarek Hope Lane. She's up in Sitka, Alaska, and he's telling us about this whole process of getting possession of a clan house there. And if you got a question, give us a call, 1-800-996-2848. We're right back after this break.
The Biden administration says it wants to work with tribes to co-manage federal land that is also sacred or culturally important. Tribal leaders are talking with officials in the Interior and Agriculture departments about what that might look like. We'll hear about those efforts on the next Native America Calling.
Support by Indigenous Pact, a healthcare consulting company working to create health equity in Indian Country. Indigenous Pact offers solutions to fit the needs of your tribe. Their team, experts in healthcare strategy, policy, and innovation, provides a one-of-a-kind plan to solve the issues specific to your community. Indigenous Pact works to create three primary outcomes: healing spaces, healthy citizens, and sustainable economies. More information at indigenouspact.com.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We're talking about Tlingit clan houses today, specifically the story of one in Sitka, Alaska. What are your thoughts or questions on the story of the Point House? Join our conversation at 1-800-996-2848. Again, that's 1-800-996-2848. Before we went to break, we were speaking with Jarek Hope Lange, and he was explaining that really at the heart of this issue and this property is the idea of collective ownership of property, which is the traditional norm there in Alaska and so many other Native communities, as opposed to individual ownership of land, which is more of the colonial approach to how property is owned. And this difference, this very, very juxtaposed ideological perspective on who owns land, is really at the heart of how this clan house and this clan lost control or possession of this clan house. And unfortunately, our other guest, Chuck Miller, he had a family emergency, folks. So unfortunately, Chuck had to leave, so he's not going to be with us for the rest of the show. But I'd like to introduce now a third guest, and she's also in Sitka, Alaska, Louise Brady. And she is also a Kiksaudi clan member. She's Tlingit. Louise, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I will introduce myself in Tlingit. My Tlingit name is Kashich Tla, and that was my great-grandmother's Tlingit name. I am Kiksadi from the Point House, which is Kahit, also known as Yukahit. And I'm grandchild of the Kaguantan Wolf Clan, also located here in Sitka. And we Kiksadi women are known as the Herring Ladies. And of course, our clan house has been here in Sitka since we migrated here following the last ice age.
Wow. Wow. So lots of history there. And thank you for that really, really beautiful introduction, Louise. And can you give our listeners a little bit more of the history of the Point House?
So the Point House, or Kahit, is one of the oldest houses of the Kiksadi. And as I said, we migrated here following the last ice age. Kiksadi had originally settled in some of us settled near what's now called Wrangell, near the Stikine River. And we are one of seven houses. So if you're not familiar with Tlingit culture, there's moieties, right? There's two two moieties, right? Every Thlinget person is born either raven or what's now called eagle, and I'm raven. And under the moiety is the clan, which is Kiksadi, so I'm raven, Kiksadi. And then under Kiksadi are the houses. So as I said, there are seven houses that came out of Sitka, out of Sitka. And then, of course, we also identify with our father's people, our grandfather's people, et cetera. And so, yes, we have many what people call stories. I don't like to call them stories. There's a good book title that I love. It's called If This Is Your Land, Where Are Your Stories? So Kiksadi people, we have original teachings, I would prefer to call them, that come from this land about the salmon boy. For instance, a lot of tribes have the salmon boy story. We have one that says exactly where the salmon boy was born, which is Bachet, in a village just north of here. We also have an original teaching about a man called Kachachkuk, who was out seal hunting and got taken away by the Pacific Ocean currents, and was gone for years and was able to return. That's Kachachkuk. And we also have many original teachings around a shaman that took place out by the volcano that's out to the west of us. Ugh. And I always think that, you know, the particular, you know, Kiksadi who came here following the last ice age, we're very wise, because if you ever have the great opportunity to visit Sitka, or what's now called Sitka, it's incredibly beautiful, and it's a place of amazing bounty. We're surrounded on three sides by mountains that, you know, rise up 2,000 feet, and then to the west is the Pacific Ocean. But as you look out to the Pacific Ocean, there's hundreds of islands that dot the coast. And then further out is Kluch, which is a volcano. And a lot of people liken it to Mount Fuji in Japan. Mm. But it's an incredibly beautiful place. And the other thing is that it's very, very abundant, and I believe that it's because of the herring that we have here. You know, my ancestors were so wise and so wonderful for choosing this place, because it's been a gathering place for thousands of years for other villages in the springtime. Up to 1,000 people would come gather here.
Louise, you've got me up. The way you're describing it, you've got me ready to want to jump on a plane and go up there right now and visit and check it out. So, yeah, it just sounds absolutely breathtaking the way you describe it. And there's a huge, huge Thlinket population there, if I'm not mistaken. And the Point House and these other clan houses, they were all in a specific part of Sitka, which is a Thlinket community. Is that how it's all laid out?
Correct. All of the clan houses were on what's now called Kutlian Street. But of course, since we are, you know, salmon people, canoe people, our clan houses were originally on the beach. And so in front of the clan house, you would, you know, sometimes you would find canoes there. We had canoe rocks that, you know, just lines of like mini boulders that you could pull the canoes up and onto. Mm-hmm. And sadly, during World War II, the federal government, the Department of War, came in and condemned all of our beachfront property and took it away. And following World War II, gave it to private landowners and the city of Sitka.
I'm sorry, Louis. So when the beach properties were condemned, given to private landowners, is that when the clan houses then moved onto this street that was more centrally located in Sitka?
Well, I mean, it's only, you know, yeah, it's just like across the street from the beach,
okay.
Really.
Okay. All mm-hmm. right. So I mean, so you must have grown up then when Point House was there and the Kiksati people were doing ceremonies and events and using it. And then do you remember when it just kind of it just stopped being used?
Well, no. So, you know, I mean, the history of the Kiksati people is tied into very much the colonization through the Presbyterian Church. So there were quite a few of Kiksati people, for whatever reason, that became members of the Presbyterian Church and then were encouraged to leave the downtown village, right? Because there was a man by the name of Dr. Sheldon Jackson who started the Indian Training School. And so many children were encouraged to go there, and people were... It's complicated.
Okay.
So okay. I would say that, you know, it was probably many, many years before I was born that there were ceremonies in the Point House in Kahit.
Okay. Well, Louise, what would it...
In disrepair in the 70s, too. Yeah.
Okay, so 50 years about then. So tell us then, Louise, I mean, what will restoring the Point House mean to you and your other Klanspeople?
It's huge because the Klan House, we're born into the Klan House, and that's where we leave this world as a Klan House. That's where we have, you know, our ceremonies. That's where our identity comes from. We have our history is passed down through Klan houses. And so the Klan House holds everything that is cultural and spiritual and historical to us, because we tell our history with these so-called stories. We tell our history with the beautiful carved ceremonial hats. We tell our history with the beautiful robes. And we're a living culture, and we've been having our ceremonies, and we've been passing along our names and our histories. And now we'll have a place to put all of the beautiful adu and the history that, because we're making history right now. It's like, you know, when we have, that's the beauty of a living culture, is that what we are doing today to protect who we are as Thinkit people, it's just like I hear stories. I hear the history of my ancestors who fought the Russians in 1804 for this land. I envision my great-great-grandchildren talking about the rebuilding of the Klan House, of bringing Adu back in, of fighting for the herring, of fighting for our way of life. And it's monumental. It's monumental. Mm-hmm.
Well, Louise, I mean, this issue going forward, though, in terms of how property is owned, based on the European models that we all live by, the laws, property rights, all European-based, what is the solution to how to pass these Klan houses down to future generations? So what happened previously there with Point House and some of these other Klan houses doesn't happen again.
Well, I think, you know, again, I think that's the beauty of having a living culture. I think, you know, that's the beauty of, you know, Jarek and myself and our other clan members will come together and talk about it. I think talk about it openly, because I think if we don't talk about these types of things, these conflicts that arise out of, not of our own doing, but out of colonization and all of the harm that came from that, if we don't start talking about these things openly, it will happen again.
And I want to, I'm sorry, Louise, I just want to go back and let Jarek chime in as well, because Jarek, I mean, now you have the deed, and hopefully there will be a new Klan House there before too long. But now how do you ensure that this Klan House at some point in the future won't find itself in the same legal limbo as the previous Klan House property?
Well, it's a wonderful question, because I think we're going to have to see more will be revealed. I think, you know, ultimately the idea of putting it into individual land ownership right now was just out of necessity to remove any outside influence to it. I think land trust is something that we've both discussed, and I have to say, I've had to decolonize myself multiple times from looking at this project, because in some ways, you know, you feel like the Land Back as a movement, I think, is kind of a new, in my mind, is fresh and new. But going backwards a little bit and saying, okay, now I have the property, now what? And I have a lot of questions, and this part of the issue of putting land into trust for me right now was like, well, what are we saying by asking for our land back? If then in order to get money from agencies and whatnot, that I have to put it back in trust. And part of that scares me, because getting land back, I don't think means giving away yet. So I think a larger discussion needs to be had on this. I don't think the answers exist. In 21st century terms, I can't go up to somebody in the street and say, have you rebuilt your clan house on a native allotment restricted deed property managed by BAA? There isn't a footprint or there isn't a model. Right. So I appreciate having Louise Brady with me, because my God, like, as you can tell, she's innovative and she's smart, and she's together collectively as a group, we'll make that decision for the property. It won't be my decision. It'll be in a collective decision with people like Louise. And I appreciate her being part of the conversation, because without people beside me, there is no conversation. So more will be revealed.
So Louise, years ago, was it just an unspoken agreement then amongst clans people that they all collectively owned the home and how it would be transferred to descendants? Is that how it worked, as opposed to having deeds and trusts and laws like we do now?
Right, exactly. So, you know, for instance, because the clan house was the center of governance, and so, you know, there's technical terms about, you know, anthropological terms, but so the male house leader would live in the clan house, and then there were certain, because we had a food economy, right, there were associated lands that came with that, of course, for harvesting. And so, right, the point house would not go to anyone outside of the clan. So the house would be passed along to the maternal nephew, right?
Maternal nephew. Well, Louise, so how many?
Whoever.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Please continue. I'm sorry.
Oh, to the sisters, you know, whoever was chosen as the next Hitsati or house leader, who would be trained in all of the tradition and history and songs, through songs and stories of that particular clan house.
So, Louise, is it safe to say then, in addition to possibly rebuilding a physical structure for the clan house for your people, will it also require some cultural revitalization so that clans people understand some of these roles you're describing now and some of these procedures for how to actually occupy and manage the clan house?
Right, exactly. And I think it's perfect, because we can use it as a traditional educational center. Because I think that, you know, I did not grow up learning the culture and learning traditions. And there's one of my favorite quotes is, you know, found in a book by a couple of Thingit scholars. And it says, tradition cannot be inherited. And if you want it, you must obtain it by great labor. And that's T.S. Eliot. So because I wasn't raised in the culture, it was people like, you know, Chuck Miller's uncle who Herman Davis, who took me in and started teaching me about, you know, how we learn, what is our history, because our history is not linear, right? It's like the words that we use in English don't translate well into Tlingit and vice versa. So I think that, you know, since most everybody, right, gets a Western education, my hope, our hope is that, you know, the Point House becomes this vessel for carrying our history, and where people can come in and we aren't exclusive about who becomes a part of, because there has been so much colonization. There has been so much.
Louise, I'm sorry, we're going to have to go to break. I'm going to let you finish those thoughts. So when we come back, 1-800-996-2848. That's our number. Stay with us.
My name is Assad. When I was 19, my mom was diagnosed with colorectal cancer because she smoked. My tip is find things to be thankful for. I'm thankful she quit smoking. I'm thankful for the nurses who taught me how to check her IV and to manage her medication. And I'm thankful for every day we have together because nothing is guaranteed, especially for us.
The people you love are worth quitting for. You can quit. For free help, call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. A message from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. We're talking about keeping the tradition of Tlingit clan houses thriving. And there's still time to join our conversation at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And we're speaking with Louise Brady, and she is a Kiksadi clan member. She's up there in Sitka, Alaska. And Louise, before we went to break, you were explaining how not only is this clan house restoration, not only is it possibly a construction project, but it's also a cultural revitalization project. And I want to ask you, how many Kiksadi clan members are there?
Oh, that's a really good question. And I don't have that answer. There's quite a few. So like I said, there's seven clan houses. And for instance, so one of the things that's happened, right, is that many of our people live in other communities. And we had somebody from, it's the Jumping Herring House, who passed away several years ago. And a lot of people thought he was the last one in that clan house. And then there was a young woman who came and visited, and her mother who came and visited, who are from that clan house. And then this year we had a ceremony, and we had two of, I think it was nine siblings come, who have another seven siblings who want to learn their culture. And I think they live in Washington. So, and some of the houses are fairly large, with probably hundreds of people in their clan house. So. That would be it'd be really interesting to find out.
Mm. Well, Louise, thanks again for all that background and all that history. And we've got another guest now, also in Sitka, Alaska, James Polson. He is an architecture historian and photo editor for the Daily Sitka Sentinel. James, welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Sean.
Well, James, we'd like to talk a little bit about the architecture, the design, the building of clan houses traditionally. Can you give us some historical details into what went into building some of these clan houses there in Sitka?
Yeah, so it's a tradition that goes back, 10,000 years, like Louise was saying. The Tlingit, when they came into this area, kind of brought with them a building style that people have traced to Japan, of all places. So the original clan houses, the earlier clan houses, would have been planked with kind of vertical planks. The structure that'd be held up by these posts on the inside, four posts that would hold up the structure, and then the outer walls were more or less like curtain walls, and they would always be facing the water, and they'd always have a central door. They're always very symmetrical. And then the names of the houses told stories, and they would kind of go into disrepair, and then they would be torn down, and then a new clan house would be built, and it would kind of reflect the kind of the status of that clan, how big it was, because it would have to accommodate the members of the clan. And so that's how it was. And then when up until Russian colonial days, and the Russians and the Tlingits battled each other, in the early 1800s. So they were always at each other's throats there at the beginning, because the Tlingit, would not just cede the land to the Russians. And there was two major battles, one in 1802, that the Tlingits prevailed, and then another battle in 1804 where the Russians prevailed, and then they set up the city of Sitka, where it is today, on top of where the Tlingits were. So,
well, that's interesting, yeah. James. So even going back to that history, going back well over 200 years and all these dealings, this invasion by Russia, but the Tlingits, they didn't adopt the Russian style of building. It's more of a Japanese style. That's interesting.
They kept their own style. They would the relations between the Tlingits and the Russians were they're contentious. But by 1820, the Russians realized that they needed the Tlingits to help them out and for survival for hunting and whatnot. So and then as far as adopting building styles, the Tlingits and they adopted one feature, I think, from the Russian style, which was to put a closure on the door. But they continued to build with these vertical planks while the Russians were building log structures. So the Russians were building kind of according to their traditions, which were from Finland and northern Russia, that area. So stacked logs, and some of those are still standing today. But the Tlingits their tradition was to kind of adapt what they wanted, what they thought was good, as a culture. So they were happy with their houses and that style of building. When the Americans came, everything kind of went up, and there was a really rapid change. There was a wall that was separating Russians from the Tlingits, and that came down. And then there were within about 10 years, all the traditional clan houses were rebuilt using kind of Western style. So this would have been 1867 onward. So these houses were stick framed after 1870. They're mm-hmm. just kind of, they look like just regular houses that you might see in Massachusetts or somewhere. They're just balloon framed houses.
And then, okay.
So not much to distinguish them, but they do have some features that you could looking at them, you say, it just looks like a regular house, but they were always facing the water, and for the most part, the gable end facing the water, and then there's this symmetry, which is really important in the Tlingit culture, and you see that in the face of the houses, and that didn't change.
James, I'm sorry. So at one point, there were 43 standing clan houses in Sitka's Indian Village District. That's according to the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training. Do you know how many of those are still standing?
Yeah, I think that somebody came up with the number 9, but it's tough because some of these houses, and Luis kind of talked about this in the 1940s. There was a bunch of fill that was put in, so all these houses that would have been up on the beach were now facing a road, and then there was a lot of pressure from the Presbyterian Church to get people out of the village and get rid of the just completely ignore Tlingit culture and just assimilate into the Western culture. That was a huge, had a huge impact on the village and the clan houses. They kind of,
So, with Point House now, this plan to rebuild the structure, what are the thoughts there amongst, and you know, maybe this is a, if this is a better question for Jarek, we can certainly ask him. But I'm just curious to know what type of architectural style will most likely be employed with this new structure. Will it be that older traditional style that you've described, or would it be more of like the Cape Cod, Massachusetts salt box kind of design that came in when the Americans came up later?
Yeah, so I think, you know, that's, you know, that my decision, but and when I wrote my paper on clan houses, and it's very exciting to me because it's not you know, it's something that hasn't been done. It's you know, going to be a reflection of a living culture. So whatever comes about, I know the architectural firm that that Jarek is talking about is Northwind Architects, and they have on their staff Clinton Architects. So there's going to be, you know, I'm sure he's involved heavily in this project as well. So
okay, let's ask Jarek if that's yeah. Okay. Jarek, what are your thoughts in terms of rebuilding Point House, in terms of the architectural style? What would people most like to see? Something more traditional, going back to the way they were originally years and years ago, like what Louise described, or something more contemporary?
My vision board is packed. I think internally I want the house to function traditionally, so I would like to pull the traditional elements. I think vernacular is a word that I was not familiar with until I read James's thesis. So I think when you look at, I mean, if you're looking at Catalina Street, there's a certain visual history that already exists. So we don't want to buck that trend. I want to maybe not blend in, be part of the fabric of the village. So I think without being from here and not being able to, especially when you're water facing, looking towards the village, there's a certain style that just is there. So we want to continue that. Fortunately for me, you know, James also laid the groundwork for me being able to look at old photos, and even in the teardown gives us some reference point to how it was built. So the beauty of this is like the firm can look at those photos and say, oh, I'm familiar with the structurally how the thing was built. Because, you know, conceptually we've talked about the house physically not being there. The house exists to us, inside of us. And I think I speak for Louise on this too, that the house is, even though it's not there in its physical structure, is a living form. So when renderings come out, I think we'll look at them and we'll discuss and share. But we're looking to be part of the architectural fiber that already exists in that village.
Okay. And James, you know, you wrote your master's thesis on clan house architecture. And then what about other Tlingit communities beyond Sitka? Are there similar clan houses? And are some of those clans also facing some of these same issues that the folks in Sitka are dealing with now with their clan houses?
Yeah, there's clan houses in Angoon and Tlingit villages all around Southeast Alaska. So, you know, my interest is in historic preservation, and it's kind of a changing field. It's a kind of combination of, you know, the sciences and also the humanities, and kind of determining, you know, what you're preserving is very important these days. And so so there's like a clan house, the Chief Kashyyyk's clan house was restored, I think using some Park Service funding. But that was, you know, the traditional, the Western traditional way, you know, just restoring it using the same materials and kind of keeping it in its, you know, 1920s form, keeping the house in that 1920s form. Mm-hmm. But you know, historic preservation should also, you know, include the cultural changes that we've seen, you know, because, you know, the Clinton culture is a living and it's a you know, vibrant and the culture. So
absolutely.
Yeah, okay.
Well, Jarek, earlier you touched on fundraising, because this project obviously, you know, there's a cost here. So where can our listeners go to just learn more about the Point House restoration project and some of these other issues that you folks are dealing with up there in Sitka right now?
Well, it is going to be pointhouse.org. We have a place card holder in place, but we're actively trying to write a grant that's due at the end of the month. So please bear with me until the end of the month. I'm also Jared Cope Lang on social media. I'm also Jared Cope Lang in the grocery store in Sitka and in Juneau, where I live. So I would recommend you approach me there. You know, I do want to touch on this because I think it's really important to this. And I want to make this happen by the end of this conversation, too, that we look at, you know, the complexity of this right now is individual land ownership. And when we talk about collective land ownership not being in trust, I think we also need to look at institutions in Seattle who are philanthropic, who are giving money, because it may be time that we decolonize the structures that exist within grant giving processes that would force us to give our land to somebody to manage for us. You know, I don't know that land to trust fits the land back model for individual clans. I'm not sure of that. Like we talked about earlier, I think one of the biggest struggles we've found is that, you know, in order for us to be considered for any historic grants and whatnot, for the most part, people want things in trust or a nonprofit. As tribal people, I don't think we have to form a nonprofit. So I would encourage Indigenous grant givers, as well as people who give to the Indigenous community, to maybe look at the structure of giving, because we don't fit the mold. I think there's a lot to this that unfortunately will leave us in the dark. But I'm looking forward to anybody, you know, reaching out. And if you are a giver and this fits the mold for what you're doing, well, number one, good for you. And number two, we would love to hear from you. Like I said, we're putting in a State Historic Preservation Office grant now for pre-development, and hopefully we'll see more. But I think a bigger conversation could be had about decolonizing the grant-giving process.
Jarek, thank you for making those closing points there. And I think that's so important for our listeners to understand at the heart of this, again, this collective versus individual ownership of land. And especially, you know, like maybe trust isn't the solution, just something completely innovative, something more Indigenous. So best of luck to you and all of your clans people moving forward. And folks, we have now reached the end of our hour. I want to thank all of our guests for this enlightening conversation on the legacy and future of Tlingit Clan Houses in Sitka, Alaska. Join us next week. We'll have a whole new lineup of discussions about Indigenous topics and issues. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Sho McPollin is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operations officer. The president and CEO of Kawanak Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. Have a great weekend.
Repatriation is the return of ancestors and stolen culture. Work with experts in the field to form strategies and build relations to better the future of repatriation at the 8th Annual Repatriation Conference, October 11th, 12th, and 13th, hosted by the Association on American Indian Affairs and the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi Indians. Learn more at indian-affairs.org. The Association on American Indian Affairs supports this show.
Program support by Amerind. For 35 years, Indian Country has put its trust in Amerind, providing insurance coverage, strengthening Native American communities, protecting tribal sovereignty, and keeping dollars in Indian Country are Amerind's priorities. More information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto needs at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.